Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, June the 12th, 1996. In the Creekside Room this evening, our speaker is Chuck Huff, continuing his series on psych fallacies. Today's session is entitled, Memory is Reliable. Let's listen in.
My name is Chuck Huff, and this is the next to the last in a series of sessions on psychological fallacies. The particular psychological fallacy that I'd like for us to think about together tonight is the fallacy that eyewitness testimony is reliable. First, let me give you some introduction about who I am. I'm a social psychologist, and that means that I study how people get along together or don't. I study how people think about each other, perceive each other, how they think about themselves, how groups work, how organizations work. This particular topic has a mixture of social psychology and cognitive psychology in it. We're mixing memory with our perceptions of others. But one of the things I would like to disclaim is being a clinical psychologist or a counseling psychologist. That is someone who sits down and talks with people about their problems. I'm a nice person, and so if you'd like to sit down and have a cup of coffee with me and talk about some problems, I'll be happy to do it. And I won't charge anything, and you'll get what it's worth. So at first I wanted to disclaim being a clinical psychologist. What I do is study people more than I do help them. I think of myself more as a scientist than I do as a clinician. Although I have at times gone in to work with organizations. My expertise comes from the research that I have done and the research of others that I have read. And as I said a little bit ago, from some small experience with organizations and small groups. When I say that I want to talk about the thing as a fallacy, what I mean is a fallacy is things that are popularly believed, but that are usually more complicated than common wisdom suggests that they are. That's the case with the fallacy that I want to deal with tonight about eyewitness testimony. Now, there are some fallacies that I've done in this series that in fact are flat wrong. For instance, the idea that we use 10% of our brain. One of the first things you should know if you think that's true is please not to go lopping off any bits because you think that you don't need them. Keep them all. Because the research suggests that we use pretty much all of them. But this particular fallacy is a fallacy because life is much more complicated than the simple picture that we often have of eyewitness testimony. The simple picture we have is the one I think is best done in evening mysteries where the eyewitness sits on the stand and points at the person and says, "Well, that's her, I'd know her anywhere." And it suggests that eyewitness testimony is the clincher in a case, in a legal case. Now, And I call it a psychological fallacy because psychologists have found that things are more complicated than that. The law still takes eyewitness testimony as the very best kind of evidence. So this is a place where psychology and the law end up disagreeing. The Supreme Court in the 1970s said that eyewitness testimony was the very best kind of testimony to get. And I hope that by the end of this session, I'll be able to convince you at least that there are some circumstances under which we ought to worry about eyewitness testimony and its validity. Some of the topics in issues of eyewitness testimony can be touchy. One of the most recent issues that I think there has been a great deal of controversy over has been the issue of adult memory for childhood events, it has been the official jargon has escaped me. Repressed memory is the way some people talk about it.
Recovered
memories is another bit of jargon that people have used to talk about it. And most of you, I suspect, have read something in a newspaper about the great deal of disagreement there is over the validity of recovered or repressed memories. So these topics are very emotional, and if we end up disagreeing, I hope that what we'll be able to do is to find out what it is that's behind each of our positions. I'd like to suggest, at least to get us started, and before I dive into research, that there are several ways that people look at memory. I've been going to the classes on ethics, and we all have had us looking at cases from different perspectives, where sometimes we're the ethicist, and sometimes we're the hospital, and sometimes we're the legislature. And I'd like to suggest that one of the ways to diffuse some of the controversy about recovered memories is to think about different uses of memory. The law has a particular use of memory, which is to use that memory as evidence to convict someone or to not convict them, to try them, to see if they did it. Clinicians who work with people who aren't very happy use memory to help those people figure out what's going on in their lives so that they can do better. This is a different use of memory than what the law wants to put memory, than the use that law wants to put memory to. There's even a third use of memory, and that's one of the ones that we're going to be talking about tonight. And that is the way psychologists, scientists look at memory. And we're interested in processes of memory, how people remember particular things, where memory comes from, where it goes when it goes away, and how it can be recalled after it may have been forgotten. So there are at least three distinct uses for memory, and we need to remember that, if you'll forgive me, when we talk about this issue. It helps to diffuse some of the anger, because very often when we talk past each other on this issue, we're talking about two different kinds of memory, or at least two different uses to which you might want to put a memory. Well, that's all by way of introduction. Let me flip past all of my wedding notes and get to, here it is, memory is reliable. As I said, one of the things I wanted to talk about was eyewitness testimony. And I suggest that it's more complicated an issue. One of the images that we have of memory, or metaphors that we have for memory, is that of a photograph. And in fact, we talk about particular people having photographic memories. Now, there are, in fact, some very fascinating people who have photographic memories. If you're interested, we can talk about some of those folks. But that's not very many people. They're very, very hard to find, people with photographic memories. And their memory, people with photographic memories, have a memory that really, frankly, is organized differently from the way we organize our memories. To get a bit ahead of the story, what I want to come out with is to suggest to you that our memory is much less like photography and much more like storytelling. And once you figure out, and once you think of memory like storytelling, you can see a whole bunch of different ways that memory might be less reliable than we think it is if we think memory is like a photograph. Let me give you one particular example that some of you may have seen a movie about titled The Thin Blue Line. Has anyone seen that? You have. It's a book, it's a movie about a case in Texas in which a fellow named Randall Adams was sent to death row based almost entirely on eyewitness testimony from about three people. It was for the killing of a policeman who had stopped another person, his car, on the road. The policeman came up to the car, and as soon as he began to talk, was shot and killed almost instantly by the driver of the car. Several weeks later, based on eyewitness testimony from others, they picked Randall Adams up. They also picked up another fellow who was much younger, who was about 15 at the time. Randall Adams was, I think, 19 or 20 at the time that the crime occurred. Well, the fellow who stole the car said he picked Randall Adams up as a hitchhiker, and Adams said, yes, that happened. But then he went on to say, and then I let Adams drive the car, and when we were pulled over, Adams reached under the seat and got my revolver, which, by the way, the fellow who'd stolen the car had also stolen, and pulled it out and shot the officer. Adams said, no, that's not what happened at all. What happened is that I was let off two, 3 hours before the crime occurred, and I was in a hotel room. Now, unfortunately, he had no eyewitnesses to testify that he was in a hotel room. Now, both of these aren't very desirable characters, but we do at least have two different stories. It was eyewitness testimony that clinched the case. There were people who had driven by and remembered the cars being stopped on the side of the road with one police car behind another car, and said they remembered a person with long blonde hair and a yellow mustache being in the driver's seat at that time. And they got three different people to testify to that. And it was that eyewitness testimony that clinched Randall Adams' case. Randall Adams was convicted, put on death row, and he served, I think, between 10 and 12 years. I can't remember exactly. Before he was released, when the prosecutors decided that the case against him was false. And they decided the case against him was false because the eyewitness testimony had been false. Think of the difficulties of identifying someone who is in a car across the street while you're driving down the highway relatively quickly. And to be able to make that kind of a good identification was impossible. Now, one of the reasons why, or at least very difficult, one of the reasons why this Randall Adams was let out is because some journalists made this film and wrote a bunch of stories about it and got a great deal of public outcry over this person having been put away. One of the reasons, by the way, the prosecutors wanted to put Randall Adams away is because he was of legal age to be tried. And they wanted to try somebody for this crime of killing a policeman. That's a very bad thing. You want to put somebody away for that. But they didn't have, but the other person was underage. And so it seemed like Adams made a much better prospect to be convicted. Researchers who have looked at legal briefs in a wide variety of cases have found at least 1,000 other cases like this in the United States of what could very well be misidentification and people convicted for misidentification based on eyewitness testimony. So I suggest that this fallacy is a particularly harmful one. Now, let me suggest to you why I think eyewitness testimony needs to be taken very carefully. There are a variety of problems with it, and I'm going to talk to you some about basic issues of police work and some about research that psychologists have done on memory in eyewitness cases. One of the first problems I'd like to talk about is the issue of Q-U-E-S. I need a board and a spell check on it. Is the issue of leading questions. Elizabeth Loftus, who's one of the experts in this area, and I think is at the University of Washington, has done a great deal of research on eyewitness testimony and memory for events. One of the things she's done is lab studies in which she's brought people into the lab, shown them a film, or had something happen to them, and then asked them later to testify about what it was that happened. And what you can do in a nice controlled lab situation like that is you can change how easy it is to see the person. You can change how long you got to see them. You can change the viewing conditions. You can change the motivation of the viewer. There's lots of interesting things that you can do in a lab that are much harder to do collecting field data. But one of the very simple studies that she's done is showing people a videotape of a car accident, what you might call a fender bender. And she asked people, after they viewed the videotape of the car accident, two different questions. So half the people got one question on their questionnaire, and the other half the people got another question. And the only difference between them was that in one, she asked them how fast they thought the car was going when it crashed into the other vehicle. And the other half of the people, she asked, how fast was it going when it hit the other vehicle? There were approximately a 20 mile per hour difference between people simply based on that difference in wording. So that the people who heard the crashed question sort of read out of the word crashed that it must have been going faster. And on average, they estimated that it was going about 20 miles per hour faster. Give you another example of leading question bias. Loftus showed people videotape of another accident that occurred when a car went through a warning sign at an intersection. And the warning sign was either a stop sign or a yield sign. So half the people saw the stop sign and half of the people saw the yield sign. The question that she asked was very similar to this one, but for half of the people she asked after they'd seen the video, how fast had the person been going when they passed the stop sign? And how fast had they been going when they stopped the yield sign? When they passed the yield sign. Right? So some people who saw a stop sign in the video got asked about a stop sign, and other people who saw a stop sign got asked about a yield sign. And some people who saw a yield sign in the video got asked about a stop sign, and other people got asked about a yield sign. They'd seen a yield sign. And then she asked them later on in the questionnaire whether there had been a stop sign or a yield sign in the accident at the intersection. And you got much higher rates of misidentification among the people who had been given the leading question to suggest that it was another kind of stop, another kind of sign at the intersection. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So they got some extra information, but the extra information wasn't from the scene they saw. It wasn't from, as we might say on television, the scene of the crime. It was from somewhere else. Lawyers, by the way, know about this. and they will use this to try to introduce things into a trial that would later be picked up by jurors as though it had happened, as though it had been testified, when in fact it was only a part of the question that they were asking. And once they get the question out, how useful do you think it is for the judge to say the jury shall disregard that question? It's not very useful. By the way, psychologists have done research on that, and they say it's not very useful. It's useful to have done the research, though, I think, because you can point at that instead of simply telling the judges that they're silly. But very often the judges don't listen to the research either. That's a whole other question about how psychological research is used by the courts. There's another problem with memory that for the moment I will call a rehearsal problem. Another one of Loftus's famous studies, particularly having to do with this issue of reconstructive, with this issue memory of childhood that you've recalled, that you used to have repressed, is Loftus has constructed childhood memories in the laboratory that people will swear are memories of their childhood. So she has gotten people in the lab with the collusion of their family members who will all come in together, and she will, and the story that she got people to do to convince the subjects in the study of was that at one time they had been lost in the mall. You know, whatever the mall is at the town where they were growing up. And the family would tell stories about this incident, which was fictitious, which they had told the family to make up. And there would be a discussion about this. And they would attempt to convince the person that, in fact, they remembered it. Now, the interesting thing about this study is that it was not only did almost all the subjects agree that they must have been lost in the mall. This is an archetypal thing, right? We can all imagine that we had been lost in the mall. Not only did people agree with the details that other people gave them from their families, but they began to remember their own details. They began to remember that the kindly man who found them was balding, or that he was overweight. And so that they embellished details in their memory because they were in the game with the family of telling this story. And they were standard story conventions that they added, right? You know, standard descriptions of character, descriptions of emotion, descriptions of action. And of course, there was a long, protracted debriefing after the study was over. Convince these people, in fact, they had not been lost in the mall, and to thank them very much for letting the experimenters do this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And again, that's a whole other issue of research ethics that we can talk about at some point if you're interested. But here we have a memory created from whole cloth. Nothing in it at all, except perhaps the archetypal story of being lost as a child and being found. And that's purely a rehearsal effect. Now, what you often find as rehearsal effects, instead of things happening out of whole cloth, is actual memories being embellished with these kinds of extra details that fit and that make sense, etc. I have a great deal of sympathy for this. I'm from the South, where they have a long tradition of storytelling and perhaps of slightly stretching the truth in the story to make it sound better. I mean, that's, or to make it work better, and that's the way most storytellers are, is they try to tell the story that really tells the story, as opposed to telling the story as it happened. But what happens when you do that is something that psychologists call source misattribution. I'm a social scientist. We really like jargon. We get excited. You misattribute the source of the memory to the original incident rather than to the telling of the story. Another way source misattribution happens is with memory for faces. If I know I'm going into a trial, or even if I don't, and I've seen your face in the paper as perhaps a suspect, I'll go into the trial and I'll say, I've seen him before. I bet he was at the scene of the crime. Well, of course I've seen you before, because I've seen your picture. But when you remember, when you have a memory, you have at least two things, right? You have the memory itself, and you have the source of the memory, where it came from. And in our brains, those two things can get unlinked. And then we can misattribute the source and say, in fact, I must have seen him at the scene of the crime. Because I know I remember your face, where else would I remember it from? And so here's another way that eyewitness testimony can go awry. Now, remember the kind of things that detectives do when they want to talk with you about the people that you've seen as an eyewitness. Very often they come to your house or to your office or you go down to their office and they've got a stack of photographs of people who might have been the suspect. Well, all of a sudden, we have a chance for source misattribution. The suspect could be in that stack of photographs. And if you see the suspect in the stack of photographs, are you going to remember that face instead of the face that was at the scene of the crime? Are you going to misattribute the source of that memory? Since we're talking about these kind of lineup issues, one of the problems in doing lineups is the best guess problem. That is, if we know that a young woman did the crime, and you bring me in as the eyewitness in a lineup, and there's three old geezers and a dog, and a young woman in the lineup, I am very likely to say that's her. Because, of course, it's the only alternative, and I'm not given a choice to be a chance really to be wrong. And so psychologists have come up with rules, and again, if you're interested, we can talk about these rules. Psychologists have come up with rules for the right way to do lineups. One of them, for instance, is to do some lineups that don't have the suspect in them. Because then you know if the person is guessing or not.
Chuck, what are they doing? You know, some of the bigger cities in the world, they're going on, they're setting cameras up through the city and they're photoing the population as they're moving. Do you know anything about that? Do you want to express something?
Your photograph is in lots and lots and lots of places if you have a cash card or if you've gotten money with your Visa card, because there's, you know, you stand in front of those little things, there's a camera behind you. Smile the next time you're there.
Even walking in a city. I don't know if I saw this on TV on 60 Minutes or 2020, but they're photoing the complete population as they're moving.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, there are two issues there that play off against each other. One of the problems, clearly for law enforcement, is this issue of eyewitness identification, which I'm trying to build a case for you, is pretty difficult. You know, and it's much better to have a picture. If you got a picture of the person running out of the bank, holding a bag, you have a much better ID than you do with a person remembering it. Even then, it's not certain. But you at least have a much better ID. On the other hand, there's a whole raft of issues of privacy having to do with that. And so to what extent are we willing to trade our privacy for better identification of criminals? Maybe the folks have been doing the ethics all this time.
It's a dilemma.
And so those at least are two real important issues I see. One, I think, is that on the one hand, it's a very good thing to help law enforcement. And they've shown, in fact, that if you have cameras out, it does reduce crime. It doesn't, and it reduces crime because people see the cameras. So cameras are useful for that purpose. But on the other hand, it also reduces privacy. And in a small town, you don't need cameras because in a small town, you don't have privacy anyway. So who needs a camera? There's a long list of difficult privacy issues in the U.S. today. You can get tracked all across the United States if you use your Visa card, and people can find out where you've been and what you do. I prefer to carry cash for precisely that reason. Because it's a lot harder to track. And any of the other kinds of things that you do, they're supposedly safer, are also much more easily traceable. I don't carry that much cash, though, so don't tell me. what I hope you're constructing in your mind, as I've been talking about some of these problems with eyewitness testimony, is that eyewitness testimony in many instances is what psychologists call constructed. We put it together. If you think about how memory works, you have a couple of things going on. You see, that's my very best, I'm sorry, I can't do any better. You see the person, and that means that there's some issues of attention and viewing conditions there. You have to then encode that information to try to remember it. And then, here you are, on the other end, you have to retrieve that information, but that retrieval is within a context, right? It's going to be in the context of a court of law, or in the context of telling a story to your grandmother, or in the context of a whole raft of other things. And the context of retrieval also matters. And psychologists have shown, and we can go into the research if you'd like, that what happens in most memory is that you construct a story to hang the details on, and you remember the details by the storyline rather than by having some photographic image of the incident. Let me give you an example of some of what I think is the most fascinating research in this area. And this work by Ulrich Neisser, who's out of Emory University, on flashbulb memories. How many people in the room remember where they were and what they were doing when the Challenger mission exploded? How many people in the room remember where they were and what they were doing when they heard about the bombing of the Marine barracks in Lebanon? Okay, that's not quite as popular a one. Very often I get a lot of hands to that one.
How about the Kennedy assassination?
The Kennedy assassination.
Pearl Harbor. I know exactly what it's doing.
Let me give you an example. Excuse me?
1929 stock market
crash. Well, anybody? Let me give you an example of Ulrich Neisser's memory for Pearl Harbor. Ulrich Neisser clearly remembers, and remember, this is the memory psychologist who's been doing this research, and this is why he got interested in this. He clearly remembers, as a small child, listening to the radio and hearing the news break in through the baseball game to tell him that Pearl Harbor had been bombed. Can somebody tell me what's wrong with that memory? It was in December. Ulrich Neisser remembered the baseball game being interrupted. See, he couldn't have had a baseball game on. They didn't do recording of baseball games and replaying them in December, usually. And so as Neisser went back to think about what had been happening to produce, and he remembered this very distinctly. It's there. He knows that's what happened. He's just as confident about that memory as he is about many of his others. When he went back to think about it, he said, well, you know, I listened to a lot of baseball games on the radio. And I must, in telling the story, have assumed that I was listening to a baseball game on the radio. So you get another issue with this unreliability of memories, that two memories got merged and put together into one. They made a fine story together, except the chronology is a little off. So Neisser became very interested in this issue of flashbulb memories, which is a distinct memory for events. And so he's initiated a long series of research into flashbulb memories. And one of the things that he's found is that, not surprisingly, many of the details in flashbulb memories are accurate. So that some of the small details that may give life to your flashbulb memory may not be accurate. I'm not saying you didn't hear it, but it may not have been your favorite rocking chair that you were sitting in. Or it may not have been at breakfast when you heard it. So that in many cases, and there are flashbulb memories that are perfectly correct. Some people, in fact, when something like that happens, look around the room and take a catalog. I've talked to people who have done that, said, because I wanted to remember where I was when this happened. And those people obviously are more likely to have correct flashbulb memories, but they're not really what we would think of as flashbulb memories, right? They're more like rehearsed memories. One of the most fascinating bits of research that Neisser did was based on some work of Richard Nixon's. Bless his heart, Richard Nixon made audio tapes of things that happened to his boss.
He sure did, didn't he?
He made more than one. And you had this wonderful then psychological experiment of John Dean coming to testify before Congress. John Dean, who was renowned among members of the administration for his sharp and clear memory. Everyone thought of him as just a crack mind. And so John Dean comes to Congress and testifies, and Congress asks him question after question after question about what happened and when happened and who said what and who was in the room and what was said And so we have this long interrogation of John Dean about things that later, lo and behold, we've got audio tape for. So we can go back and listen to the audio tape and find out how correct John Dean was. The answer? Not very. What John Dean had great memory for was what psychologists call gist. Some real people call it gist. He remembered the tone of a conversation very well, whether the president was angry or worried or pleased. He remembered whether he got compliments or not. There were actually a couple of times he was wrong. He thought he got some and he didn't. He remembered, in general, what was decided and what was done based on what was decided. But he got the sequences all mixed up. And he got the details all mixed up with regard to, and here's somebody who's been trained and who is widely known for having a great memory at very important meetings, who, when he's asked, and who's trying his very, to be honest, he wasn't trying to mislead Congress at all when he was talking. He was simply doing his very best to remember.
What was the time lapse between the actual meeting and then his...
I think those lapses were sometimes between 1 and 2 years. This is not at all an unusual time lapse to have in a court of law. And I don't want to just, if you like John Dean, I don't want to make you think he's a bad guy. He has a great memory. But he has a great memory the way those of us who have good memories, which is we remember gist. We don't remember detail. And if we remember details because we looked for it, and we wrote it down, or we listened to it, and we thought about it, and we rehearsed it again and again, yes.
One thing, I don't know how many, I was deposed once for a trial, and our company attorneys kind of ran me through a dry run, and the one thing that they really made stick out was they said, if you don't remember, don't guess. If you're not 100% sure, simply say, I don't remember. And I said, I don't remember a lot of times.
Unfortunately, the position that puts you in is a very bad one when it comes to popular conception and when it comes to jurors who will be listening to it. Let me give you an example of a study that was done. In a lot of these studies, what happens is we have a captive audience, say, a classroom, right, like this one, and we stage a crime. Somebody comes in, shouts at me, pushes me, grabs my watch, and runs out of the room. And so this was done in this particular study. And the person who came in and did that either had no hat on at all, or had a hat on that was pulled down a little bit to obscure some of the details of his identity, or he had a hat on that was pulled really way down, right?
Sounds so good to me.
Yeah. So you couldn't tell, it's like the stocking cap over your face sort of thing. Well, what they found, if this is percent correct, that is the number of people who are correct at identifying the person, and this is the easy, medium, and hard to identify conditions. What you found was something about like this for the eyewitness's ability actually to identify the individual. The sort of thing you'd expect, right? It's a lot harder to identify. When they took those very same eyewitnesses and they put them up in front of what we call mock juries, which are juries set up to play a trial rather than really do a trial. They found out that the confidence of the jurors was like that across the three conditions, based on the eyewitness testimony. So those people who were in the heart, who were, I bet it backwards, gentlemen. No wonder it's confusing. That better?
Yeah.
Good. So the people who were in the hard to identify condition didn't do very good, but the jury were pretty sure they did okay. And it's also the case that that jurors will use confidence of an eyewitness as a clue to whether they can trust them. Well, that's not surprising, right? In fact, across all of these studies, both studies done in the field and studies done in the laboratory, there's absolutely no relationship between confidence and accuracy in eyewitness testimony.
How is the changing of habeas corpus going to be affected by?
You don't have to unpack that for me. I'm a psychologist.
Well, okay. The Supreme Court is limiting appeals in death penalties, and it seems like we're saying eyewitnesses are less accurate, and capital punishment cases are going to be deaths, and they're going to be eyewitness.
Well, it's hard to let people out of jail if they're dead.
If
the person who's been convicted of doing the crime is found innocent after they're dead, it's sort of hard to let them out of jail. Now this is independent of whether you're in favor of the death penalty or not. The issue, I think, is if you're in favor of the death penalty, let's at least make sure we kill the right ones.
Have your colleagues and yourself talked it over about, you know, about jury trials, about what you think the percent that's out there that's tried and that just is kind of hazy, but they came to an agreement, the jury came to an agreement, and they said they're guilty, but they really weren't?
Well, that's less of a question about eyewitness testimony, but let me try to answer at least what we know.
Okay.
People have done the kinds of studies that you're suggesting, which is to go back and look at the evidence based on what we know about psychology, et cetera.
Yeah.
And what they found is that in cases where the evidence is pretty good, that is, where the evidence is reasonably clear that the person is innocent or the person is guilty, juries do a really fine job. The problem, of course, is in those cases where the evidence is ambiguous. And not surprisingly, that's a chance for more error to enter the system. It's a chance for more for people's feelings about something. As in the case of Randall Adams, where they felt like they really had to punish somebody for this really heinous crime. Now, unfortunately, there's also the issue of eyewitness testimony, which is often used as a clincher in a case. And now we know that eyewitness testimony is, in many cases, not reliable. Let me suggest to you a couple of things that would be important to think about in terms of whether a particular bit of eyewitness testimony is useful. You need to think about the conditions under which it occurred. People watched the film 12 Angry Men. It's a great film.
Excellent.
It's really, Henry Fonda is just, he's classic. I really suggest that you read it. It's in black and white, but it's great drama. And one of the turning points in that, in the discussion of this jury over whether a fellow is guilty, is Henry Fonda pointing out that the person who fingered them as being guilty at the time they were watching didn't have their glasses on. And that it was dark. And so that the viewing conditions were really quite poor. And so that bit of persuasion on Fonda's part helped to turn the tide in the jury, and they found the person innocent. And of course, as the omniscient film viewers, we know the person really was innocent. So viewing conditions are really very crucial. One of the things that you need to remember, if someone is in here committing, if someone walks in this room and points a gun at me, what are you going to look at?
Look at you.
You. No.
Look, you're going to be looking at the floor, probably, right?
Most people in an instance like that look at the gun. They look at where the danger is coming from. And so if I'm looking at the gun, I might be able to identify the gun in a lineup. But it's a little harder for me to identify the person. So that's another viewing condition issue that you have to think about.
Isn't the timing critical also? I mean, if the crime's committed today and tomorrow you're called to testify, it's fresh. But if the crime's committed today and you're not called to testify for a year, you haven't even been thinking about this for a year, and all of a sudden you have to try to recall what happened 12 months ago.
That's right.
And who knows what
That's
they
right.
had for breakfast yesterday.
That's right. Timing really is crucial, but it's not crucial for the reason many people think that it is. It's not crucial because of the photographic memory issue that, like a picture, it decays over time. It's crucial because there is this very short decay process before rehearsal is going to take place. And when rehearsal takes over, this is why I tell people if they see a crime in an organization or if they witness sexual harassment in an organization, the thing to do is to start a journal almost immediately. Because if you start a journal and write things down and get dates and have other people look at your journal, one of the things at least that establishes is that you remembered it close to the time that it was going on, and that there's a much higher chance that your memory is accurate and it hasn't been elaborated on over time, because all you've got is what you wrote down at the time.
You can't take a journal though in the courthouse with you.
Well, a journal can count as evidence in court, the same way that a photograph that you've taken of a person can count as evidence. It counts as evidence because you testify that it's accurate.
Oh, I see. That's what you can count.
Right? Because you sit in court and say, yes, I took this journal entry at this particular time, and what they're doing is taking your word that this is the thing that happened.
Okay.
So they don't put the journal on the witness stand, they put you on the witness stand. But the journal helps to make your case better.
Okay.
Because it helps to reduce. By the way, psychologists are now being called in by the SCADs into legal issues precisely because of these sorts of things. We don't have very much time, but I want to at least make a comment about the issue of adult memories of childhood abuse. I want to suggest that childhood abuse doesn't occur, nor do I want to suggest that people can't remember details when they're adults of childhood abuse. We all forget things and then remember them. There would be a lot fewer pairs of socks in the world if that were not true. So there very well may be instances where people, after having repressed or simply forgotten childhood abuse who now remember it. On the other hand, we need to think very carefully about accusations from adults about their parents about childhood abuse, given what we know about the reliability of eyewitness testimony. So I don't want to suggest that it doesn't happen or that some adult memories aren't correct. But I do want to suggest that we need to be much more careful. Now, having said that, many clinicians use as a rule, always believe your client. Particularly advocates use this as a rule. And my first wife is an advocate for rape victims and others. And I understand why you need to have that as a rule. But that's not the rule in courts of law. And we're using memory for a different thing in the court of law than we are when we're doing therapy with a person to help them work out the story of their life. So the thought that eyewitness testimony is reliable is a fallacy, not because it's never reliable, but because there are only limited circumstances in which it's reliable.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.